So talent, energy, dedication, discipline, passion, innovation, education, drive, mind, body, spirit, vision, honor, truth, and drums make the man. And Kenny Aronoff, voted as Rolling Stone Magazine's one of the greatest drummers of all time, is arguably the most sought-after recording and touring beatmaster ever. He's worked with the likes of John Mellencamp, Melissa Etheridge, John Fogerty, Bon Jovi, Stevie Nicks, Smashing Pumpkins, The Bodines, Paul Westerberg, Celine Dion, Elton John, Bob Dylan, Alice Cooper, Meatloaf, Joe Cocker, and countless others. And he's joining us once again tonight.
How you doing, man?
I am great. I was just sharing with you before we got started here that watching you play, it's, to me, it's art. I mean, it's absolutely, first of all, it's exhausting watching you play. It's exhausting. Yeah. But it is absolutely amazing. I got to like stand like 5 feet away from you during a Bodines concert when you were in Chicago a couple years ago. And nothing short of incredible, my friend.
Thank you. That's awesome. Thank you. I'm glad you appreciate that. I mean, I don't, it's not, I don't choose to be that. Yeah. I mean, I choose to be that way, but I am wired that way.
Yeah.
And I, even last night, I wake up and I went to bed, slept 4 hours typically, woke up, went downstairs because I didn't want to wake my wife up, and then I started practicing on my legs some new techniques to add to my 30-minute routine I do that I call functional practicing. It's a designed specifically to make me sound 3% better than I normally do if I do this 3 times a day.
Wow.
Every second is designed to work certain techniques out that I use every night when I play. So I'm not wasting any time. And I thought, man, I should really add this to it. And this is the way my brain works. So, yeah, when I play, it doesn't matter if it's an unsigned artist in my studio and nobody's watching, or if I'm playing Kenny Sinaranos or the Fogerty Bodines, you know, anybody, it's the same to me.
It is.
I've got to play perfect.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've had quite a life. And when I first talked to you about 4 years ago, I thought to myself, this guy's got to write a book. And that's about as long, I think, that it took you to put this book together, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it took a long time. Not an easy task. And I didn't really want to do it because I had a feeling it was going to be a lot of work. And God, was I right. And, you know, I'm busy enough as it is. And I now know why people don't write autobiographies.
Well, your first submission was like almost 250,000 words, wasn't it, the first time you put it together?
I think it was like 600 pages and the contract's for 300.
Oh, God. So, that's a couple volumes right there, my friend. That's what that is.
And at one point I literally had a checkbook in my hand and I had Hal Leonard on the other line saying, listen, I'm ready to buy this book back and bury it. This book ain't happening. And it's just like a lot of great things. You get to that point, and I felt that, you know, I had already gotten interviews from John Bon Jovi, John Mellencamp, John Fogerty, most athletes, Billy Corgan. I mean, there was no turning back in a way, or I guess I could have buried it, but the point is, if it was going to come on, I had to make sure that it was decent, you know, and good. And well, I think we're there.
Well, I mean, and plus, it allowed you to reflect on this journey that you've had and really go back in detail, because I know you've kept calendars and weekly planners that documented every single session and every single gig that you've ever done. So to be able to walk through that step by step and relive it, that must have had a great impact on you.
Yeah, because I never look back. I don't even play the stuff I played on. It never is good enough to me. I mean, I have this phrase that I'll never be as great as I want to be, but I'm willing to spend the rest of my life trying to be as great as I can be. It's just, it's like being a running back. You don't score touchdowns every time, but you just keep trying. Anyway, that's just kind of the human condition, and I've accepted that, and that's cool. And that's what makes it possible for me to keep going, because I realize, you know, you're not going to be perfect. You're going to have bad days. You know, but the big picture is that I'm getting better and better still, and I love what I do. And, it's been, I had to look back and look through my life, and then that was definitely, wow, there's a lot of therapy in that.
Yeah, I bet.
I'll tell you this,
I bet.
I mean, it was like I had to relive a lot of stuff. It wasn't bad. It just took a lot of work. And then I asked myself, the big question I asked myself was, wait a minute, how do I do this? How did a little kid that, you know, saw the Beatles that famous Ed Sullivan show, when I was 11 years old in 1964, the Beatles playing on the Ed Sullivan show. How did a little kid who saw that end up playing with the Beatles, honoring them for that show 50 years later?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, how did that happen and all the stuff in between? And I answered it with, I came up with seven ways I believe people can be successful and stay successful, because these are the same seven ways that led me to have this extraordinary career in one of the most difficult businesses in the world, the music business. Because, I mean, I never asked myself that question before, and then finally I answered it with seven things, stuff like self-discipline, hard work, communication skills, getting along with people, that's huge. Being able to execute a plan that reaches goals. Healthy life is a wealthy life. You got to be healthier mentally, physically, and emotionally, or everything.
I think that's one of the best stories cover to cover, though, reading this book, is knowing, the influence that you had watching the Beatles on Sullivan. And then again, when mm-hmm. the Beatles had their celebration, you were playing on stage with Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. I mean, really, your life has come full circle.
Yeah, I mean, what a lucky break for me to have that, because that ended up being a great kind of way to bookend my book. I mean, I didn't plan that, but it sure is nice. What a way to, it's basically, this is how it goes. Dreams come true, but not by accident.
Yeah.
I made them happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dreams come true, not by accident. I made it happen. Meaning, if I hadn't done those seven things, worked my butt off and practiced, always 8 hours a day whenever I had those opportunities, and bust my ass and never sit on my laurels, and even when I made it, I worked just as hard as I do now. That made it so that I was available in people's faces. So when it was time to have somebody do that show, they called me.
Absolutely. And they still call you. Yeah, and they still call you. And I know you were self kind of taught playing the drums. You grew up in Massachusetts, but you chose Indiana University. Tell folks why Indiana University.
Well, Indiana University was the number one school in America in classical percussion. And I, when I was a little kid, there was nobody to teach me drums, so it was all new, this rock and roll thing. And I grew up in a little town of 3,000 people, so it was, when we saw rock and roll, there was nobody to teach us, so I was self-taught. But the Boston Symphony Orchestra summer program, I guess you guys have like Ravinia, right?
Right. You got it. Okay. And you've been there.
So yep. We have a thing called Tanglewood that was 3 miles from the house. I started taking lessons from the percussionist. And that guy, Arthur Press, directed me towards classical music. I started learning timpani, mallets, orchestral snare, reading, sight readings, music theory, you name it. And in my family, we all went to college. And so I couldn't get into Indiana University. I wasn't good enough. But I went to UMass. And then that first year at UMass, I was not the best by a long shot. But I had started practicing 8 hours a day the summer after I graduated high school. I was partying. I was practicing because I was scared to, go to as a freshman and be behind. Because I wasn't playing in concert band or orchestra and symphony band and marching band. I was a jock, and so I played sports, and I had a rock band. I was playing in clubs when I was 13.
The Alley Cats,
so why
right?
Why would I want to listen to a squeaky clarinet when I could be playing Led Zeppelin, the Beatles, James Brown, you name it. So anyway, in my freshman year, I tried, even though it wasn't the best, I already was trying to leave UMass, and I went to Aspen School of Music, which was run by
Juilliard. Yeah.
Top three schools.
Sure.
And just really, I was chasing after this hot cellist. I heard she was going, so I auditioned. I got in. He didn't go. She bailed.
Oh.
I went. And that's where the teacher who taught at IU in Bloomington was teaching, and I completely was blown away by him. He was not just a good teacher, but he was a deep thinker. He was an extreme disciplinarian. I just knew it was good for me. So I demanded an audition up there to come to Indiana University. He tried to sway me to audition in January. I put my foot down and said, no, I want to come now. I auditioned. You had to have four different people from four different departments to audition in front of, and there were four different departments. Like up there in Austin, you had woodwinds, brass, vocals or piano, and then percussion. I auditioned, got in, spent 4 years in Bloomington.
Wow.
in all 4 years, that was the number one school in the country. And very, very hard to get into, but you had to work your butt off to stay in.
Well, stick around. There's more with legendary drummer Kenny Aronoff after the news next. All right, it's Dave Plyer, 720 WGN, from John Mellencamp to the Rolling Stones, Sting, Bob Dylan, Paul McCartney, Bruce Springsteen, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Elton John, Lady Gaga, the Smashing Pumpkins, and more. Legendary Kenny Aronoff is joining us. So early on, you started a band called the Alley Cats. That was Beach Boys inspired, right?
Beach Boys and Beatles.
Beach Boys and Beatles. Pretty cool. And that was kind of where you first got your feet wet in your own band. And then in 1980, you joined John Mellencamp, John Cougar at the time.
Yeah, what happened was, I call it the American dream. You go to school, get a degree in something, and then you get a job in the field that you studied. I did. I got into the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra and key director there, but I still wanted to be in the Beatles. My heart dominated, my passion dominated my intellect, and that was, I kept telling myself, you should do this orchestra gig, but I didn't want to. I'd rather play in a club playing rock and roll, rock, R&B, fusion music, making $75 a night, because that's really what I want to do. And so then I spent 4 years busting my ass, moved back to Indiana, had my own band. The idea was to get a record deal, get signed, make records and tour. Didn't happen. And then I heard about this Johnny Cougar guy that lived in Bloomington, Indiana, of all things. Auditioned, got the gig.
And John's guitar player told you right off the bat, welcome to hell. More, which is, wow, hey, thanks. Thanks, buddy, for the first. But referring to his rigorous rehearsal schedule, I mean, he was pretty tough.
Oh, it was great. I praise him for it. I mean, I think that the only way you can make it is from self-discipline and hard work. And John had us working from 11 in the morning to 5 at night, and then it did a break 7 to 11, 5 days a week, and it was like a business. And that's how we came from being a club band into a venue to eventually arenas, you know. And it just came from hard work. And the people that are lazy and feel self-entitled, you do nothing, you get nothing. It's like math.
So true.
Zero equals zero.
Yeah, man.
And we weren't that. We worked our asses off. And as we were making hits and being successful, we continued to do that. And I was already that guy anyway. But seeing that in rock and roll was really awesome. And I have used that business model to stay successful my entire life. And as, when John quit, I broke into session work. And I use that same business model to become successful at that. And, I'm the book, I'm doing speaking engagements now. It's once you learn discipline, man, you can apply it to anything,
absolutely,
including raising a family.
Playing with John, tell us the story about behind Jack and Diane.
Well, Jack and Diane wasn't on the record because we didn't know what to do with it. It was a simple song. It had great lyrics. We all knew it was a cool song, but we weren't educated enough to know how to arrange it. So, we went, didn't work it out in the studio, in home, in a rehearsal place, which typically becomes a bigger problem in the studio. And we kept hearing this weird drum machine sequence pattern coming out of the room next to us in Criteria Studios in Miami. It was the Bee Gees, and they had this Lin drum machine, basically a drum machine, and it was playing the beat. They were trying to be hip and modern, too, because the whole disco thing was, big.
Sure.
And so our engineer walked in with that once, and I was just mortified that I would be replaced by a drum machine.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just grabbed the thing from him and said, give me that thing. If anyone's going to program it, I wanted to at least have my touch on it. So I did. I programmed the beat I was playing on a drum machine using different sounds. Instead of like hi-hat, I had tambourine on the Lin drum machine. And instead of kick drum, it was a pitch tom-tom. And then I went into the lounge and played pool, kind of all bummed out, I'm being replaced by a drum machine. And, nowadays that's this common, but back then it wasn't that common. So then all of a sudden I hear John yelling, Aronoff, get Aronoff in here. And he said he wanted a drum solo. And I kept thinking, a drum solo on a ballad? I was thinking...
Right. I'm with you. I hear you. Yeah.
I was going, I was into Buddy Rich and all these technique guys. And I went, God, what would Buddy Rich do? And I thought about it. I went, Well, Buddy Rich would say, get rid of that damn song. It stinks. Can't solo on that. But that wasn't the case.
No.
So I basically, long story short, I was fighting for my job at that point. Two guys had been fired. It was a very tense situation making that record, and rightfully so. John felt like he was going to be dropped, and we did eventually get dropped. Ironically, on that record, and that record won a Grammy in the end. So a great rock and roll story. But basically, I had to compose a piece of music. It wasn't really a drum solo. It was a piece of music that had hook lines and the rhythm that you could imitate, and people would air drum for the rest of my life.
It's a critical part of the song, absolutely.
It's huge, man. It was huge, and it didn't come easy, but I did it, and I'm proud of it, and it launched my career, and, I never thought that it was all done. When I finally that song went to number one, I was more afraid that it was number one than if it hadn't made it, because I thought, how can I do this again? Am I really number one? No. Like I said, I'll never be as great as I want to be, but I'll spend the rest of my life trying to be as great as I can be. And I didn't think I was number one at all. People are going to think I'm number one, but I'm not number one. What am I going to do next? How am I going to keep this going? So what do I practice? How do I get better, you know?
And you still do that, and I know that's how you still feel.
Yeah, definitely. You know,
now I know with John, you were on Saturday Night Live. You performed with the original Not Ready for Primetime Players. You've been on Saturday Night Live multiple times, not only with Cougar Mellencamp, but with the Pumpkins, and I think Willie Nelson. Maybe was Willie Nelson or Paul Simon?
Willie and Paul Simon together. Yeah. Yep, six times I did. That's a great show. That's very live.
Yeah, it is. I'm sure it is. And then you played Farm Aid with John, which was the first time you also met John Fogerty, which also turned out to be a two-decade-long friendship, if not more.
Oh, man. Dude, I was rolling joints on Creedence Clearwater Records and, you know, thinking, God, that guy's voice is so amazing. And, reading... Can I say joints on the radio?
You've said it a few times too, so I'm fine with that. It's late night. We're good with that.
Okay, good. So all you fans listening, I hope I didn't offend you. I won't say it again.
Not at all.
I'm so blessed. I'm so lucky. Somebody told me you're going to play with John Fogerty from Creedence Clearwater, the singer of Born on the Bayou. When I was 13 years old, listening to his stuff, I would have fainted. And so, yeah, playing with him has been one of the iconic moments of my life, you know? Unbelievable.
And then, you know, you started playing with the Bodines, which is how I've seen you and known you for the past 30 years, and in studio, too, here with Kurt. And then you got a call from someone asking if you would be interested in auditioning with a bass player of your choice for Mick Jagger. I mean, holy cow. Right. Do you want to, is the question. Oh, yeah, sure. Why not?
Dude, I got that call. I would definitely, the adrenaline level went up. And I remember I was so pumped.
Yeah.
We got into SIR Studios where we were playing. I set up the drums. As soon as I got the drums set up, I started just getting this funky beat, you know. Mm. I remember the other guys all looking at me like, what are you doing? I mean, it's Mick Jagger, man. I'm like, I'm thinking, I don't care, man. I'm just laying this dude down. The Mick starts dancing, doing that rooster thing he does, you know?
Yeah, the energy, right?
And then we just did this song, and I got the gig, you know? Me and the bass player got the gig, but then I ended up not being able to do it because they kept changing the schedule, and I was booked with Mellencamp.
All right, well, we are talking to legendary drummer Kenny Aronoff, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN. And that is legendary drummer Kenny Aronoff playing the 56th Annual Grammy Awards with Ringo Starr singing Photograph, his number one single with celebrity recruits of his all-star band. All right, so word started getting out that you could play just about everything, Kenny. Hard rock with Alice Cooper, B.B. King and the blues, Johnny Cash and country, Elton John. They were flying you all across the world to have you play.
Yeah, man, that's the truth. That's why I was able to live in Indiana for so long, because they'd just fly me anywhere. Everybody knew me at the airport. I'd show up with two cases of snare drums, and I had two kits in L.A., two in Nashville, one in New York, or two in New York, and I had one in Japan, one in Germany. I just fly everywhere, make records. I think one 2-week period was rehearsing with Fogerty for his first tour in 20 years to play Creedence songs from 12 to 6, from 7 o'clock until 11 at night. I was working with Roy Bittan from Springsteen's band. He was producing artists. And from midnight until 6 in the morning, I was recording with the Rolling Stones. And on the weekend, Bon Jovi.
Wow. Now, I was going to say, and I'm going to embarrass you a little bit because the list is endless. And I mentioned just a few of them in the beginning of the interview, but just looking at the stories from this book, The Smashing Pumpkins, Bob Seger, John Fogerty, Melissa Etheridge, Joe Cocker, Willie Nelson, Michelle Branch, Styx, The Goo Goo Dolls, The Bodines, Ringo, Dr. John, Greg Allman, The Stones, Smashing Pumpkins, Springsteen, Ringo, Bob Seger, Melissa Etheridge, John Bon Jovi, Elton John, Bob Dylan, Rod Stewart, Steven Tyler, Dave Grohl, Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, Sheryl Crow, Ray Charles, Alice Cooper, B.B. King, Bonnie Raitt, Santana, Patti LaBelle. I mean, look at this stuff. It's just the list is overwhelming, Kenny. I'm going to tell you.
It's crazy, I know. It's crazy. You know, the thing is, when I look back, I don't pay attention to that stuff. All I'm thinking is like, well, what am I doing next week? It's over. It's not. I got Billy Gibbons coming up, a Paul Simon thing coming up. I've got Fogerty thing coming up, Bodine's coming up, and I've got I'm meeting Sammy Hagar thing coming up. It's just,
your energy is amazing, man. I'm
very fortunate. Well, I take care of myself, you know.
You've played on Grammy specials. You talked about presidential inaugurations, Kennedy Center honors, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and with Paul Schaefer. And I know you filled in actually with Paul on the CBS orchestra when Letterman was still on the air.
50 times.
Wow.
And the first time was great because I'm like flying from Japan. I did some big special out there. Well, I was playing with everybody anyway. I got flying, and the first day I'm on the show, I mean, it's like you have to learn the theme, and there's all these, like, the rehearsals for 30 minutes, and you have to come up with all this walk-on music, walk-off music. Paul's got a list of 350 songs. I narrowed it down to 30, and he'd say, okay, well, we'll bring this on, and there's all these cues and blah, 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 and I'm nervous, and we get through the theme, and we get through walking somebody on, and then all of a sudden, this guy walking, I was doing this stupid human text. And I'm looking at my notes, and I'm nervous, and I'm sweating. I'm like, God, I'm almost done. And Dave says, what are you going to do? He said, well, I'm going to get do a handstand. There's a mirror under the gym, and you tie a yo-yo to my toe, and I'm going to yo-yo. And David goes live on the air, goes, Anton, get up here. He says, oh, wait, you don't have Anton. Kenny, get up here. I'm like, me? don't want to waste time. I'm like, yeah, get up here now. So I go running up there. Says, okay, Ken, you understand? He's going to do a handstand, you're going to tie the yo-yo to his foot. I'm like, okay. And I'm like, there I am, center stage, David Letterman show. And the guy goes up, and his feet are moving all over the place. And Dave's trying to get the yo-yo on. I'm like, I'm trying, but his foot, I couldn't get. Every time I try to tie it, his foot goes flying. So finally I get it tied. And Dave says, well, go back and hit a snare roll for me. It was so embarrassing.
But how fun. I mean, what a great experience. And, shortly thereafter, you came in studio. I think it was around New Year's. It was for a New Year's show you played that I went to. And you and Kurt from the Bodines came in the studio and you hung out here. And it was just a couple months later, I think, that came the Beatles, The Night That Changed America. And I swear, I just turned it on for just a few seconds and I'm sitting in the chair and, I'm almost 50, so I need glasses sometimes. And I'm looking at him like, that's Kenny. That's him on stage. And I walked right up to the set, and I was like, oh, my God. How surreal was that, coming full circle to playing with Ringo and Paul?
Oh, man. First of all, I did not think about it too much.
Yeah.
I focused on doing my job. I didn't want to mess up there. For every lick I play, I mean, Ringo's playing, so I was trying to be very, very accurate and respectful to him. So basically, in between every, they would set the stage for the next artist, I was practicing the count off with a click track and everything. Just literally, I got this thing I called RPS. Repetition is the preparation for success. Repeating anything over and over and over again is a repetition. Is that repetition of that thing is the preparation for success. So I was repeating over and over and over again the count off, the first beat, the first fill, so that when they said go, I was already in the groove and in the pocket, and I made no mistakes, and it was fantastic, you know. And I, and then afterwards, that's when I flipped out and had incredible conversations with Paul and Ringo, and I just couldn't believe it. It was like a lifelong dream came true.
Well, you got to play also, wasn't Stevie Wonder, Alicia Keys, John Legend, Keith Urban, mm-hmm. Pharrell Williams, Joe Walsh, Dave Grohl. Mm-hmm. I mean, all on stage. That night was one of the biggest nights in music, watching that performance.
That's how I felt.
Yeah.
Man. I felt like that. There's a shot of Ringo air drumming to a fill. The only way I knew that fill existed was Don was a producer. Somehow got me tracks of Ringo's drum parts separated from the rest of the music. It was something. The song's called Something. Something in the way of da-da-da to rack time, four time. I didn't know. You hear it on the record. It's like, what's he doing? Is it duck-a-duck-a or sextuplets, what? But when I heard that by itself, I heard it, and when I did it, there's Ringo smiling at me on TV, mimicking that role.
All right, well, Kenny Aronoff will be taking the seat behind the drums for Joe Satriani in his 2024 G3 tour. They'll be joined by guitarist Eric Johnson and Steve Vai, reuniting the original G3 guitar trio. And you can hear Kenny's podcast, The Kenny Aronoff Sessions, on YouTube. And for more on Kenny, visit kennyaronoff.com. Next time you're in Chicago, Kenny, swing on by.
I will, man. I'll just come by. Is that all right?
All right. That sounds awesome. The door's always open, Kenny. All right. Take care of yourself.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. It's 720 WGN.